You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In 1947, a funeral was held for former Vancouver Mayor Jerry McGeer. McGeer was remembered by some as one of the great mayors of the city, a flamboyant Depression-era politician. He was responsible for such monuments as City Hall and Lost Lagoon. But that was not how Bill White remembered him. White was a labor leader in one of the largest local unions in Canada, and when he heard the name McGeer, he thought of the reactionary mayor who sent mounted policemen charging into jobless demonstrators in 1935. A journalist asked White to comment on the wonderful tribute paid to McGeer. The journalist was referring to the 20,000 people who had joined the funeral procession. But White's reply shocked him. White said, "That was no tribute. Them people just come out to make sure the old bugger was dead." That racy anecdote is one of the many that can be found in A Hard Man to Beat, the story of Bill White. The biography of White was reissued last year by Harbor Publishing. Howard White is the author, and he has joined me on the line from his home on the Sunshine Coast. Good morning, Howard.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Now, how did you first meet Bill White?
Oh, totally by coincidence. And incidentally, even though we're both named White, we're not in any way related. I live in Pender Harbor, as you mentioned. It's a very small town on the Sunshine Coast. And after we'd been here about 10 years, Bill White retired and bought property up here, and my dad was the local bulldozer operator, and he hired my dad to clear his property so he could build his retirement house, and that's how we got to meet him, and he became a great friend of my dad's. My dad was a couple years younger than him, and he's still living. He's 98 this year, and so they became great pals. They were both kind of on the left side of the local political controversies and fell together often, and so I got to know Bill that way.
And what prompted you to get interested in writing his history of his life and his struggles?
I was starting Harbor Publishing in the early 70s. I'd run a local newspaper starting in 1969, and then it morphed into Raincoast Chronicles in 1972. And one of the things I really liked to do was go around talking to old-timers who had stories to tell and taping them, and then editing the tapes and publishing them as vernacular history. And I noticed that it was very popular with people. People really liked reading other people talking in a natural way. And so I wanted to try doing a whole book like this in one person's voice, and was kind of on the lookout for a subject. And Bill was a great storyteller. That's basically all he did after he retired, was sit around telling stories and going fishing. And I thought, here's a guy with a great story. And the story that we both thought that he had to tell when we started out was about the years when he was with the RCMP during the 30s, and he got posted to the Arctic on the famous supply ship, the St. Rock, and he went up there with Captain Henry Larson and got put ashore and looked after the Cambridge Bay Post and had all the typical dog sledding, Mountie gets his man experiences that Mounties of that era did, and it was sort of classic Arctic traveler stuff. And he wanted to do a book of that, and I thought it sounded interesting, and we started taping it, but everything that he talked about reminded him of something else, and that something else was an experience that he had more recently in his life, and which was a more more powerful experience, as I came to realize. And that was his years as the head of the Marine Workers Union in Vancouver during the war and for 10 years after the war. And we got sidetracked into that story so often that after a while I said, Bill, you know, I'm really liking these stories you have of labor. I didn't think anybody could ever make labor history sound so dramatic and colorful and interesting. And why don't we just do a book on that? So that's how we got that's how the book came about.
Well, that's an interesting shift, and it's interesting that you detected that his real passion was in those labor struggles.
It was a much, I mean, the Mountie book eventually did get done, and it's a good story, but it's like a lot of books about Mounties up in the north. But the labor one is kind of unique. I'd never encountered anybody who, you know, saw and was able to describe the labor movement as a great battleground with its own heroes and its own villains and its own bloody battles, and make it, you know, quite a gripping story.
You spoke earlier on the success you had of taping people in their own voice, their own speech pattern, their own vocabulary, and that had a real response, it resonated with people. Would you say it resonated with people who really were the working people of BC, and that was the main audience you wanted to get, and so you continued that with Bill White's story?
Yeah, I've always been interested in different levels of language and how we have an entirely different kind of communication for formal written speech than we do for the kind of thing we're doing right now, just two guys talking to each other. And most people don't realize there's such different worlds. If you copied down a transcript of what we're saying right now and printed it, it would be all full of pauses and jumps in topic and so on, and it wouldn't seem right. But at the same time, if somebody reads from a formally written speech, the audience senses that something's wrong. This person is not sounding natural, and so they are two different kinds of communication, and I've always been interested in the informal one, the vernacular speech, because I think a lot of natural talent and skill goes into it, and I found that if you were able to replicate some of those natural speaking habits and techniques on the page, that people picked up on it right away and found it more engaging than sort of standard English.
When Bill became involved in the labor movement, what was the step that drew him into that activism?
Again, it was kind of coincidental. He came back from serving with the RCMP in the north, and he could have gone on with the RCMP, but it was the middle of the Depression, and he found that most of the jobs they were getting sent out on was to control demonstrations by the unemployed, and he didn't have any taste for that, so he quit. And then he was out of work, and he had a young family and had to find a job. And in Vancouver at that time, just as the war was breaking out, the big job in town that everybody was flocking to was in the shipyards, because I know people are quite excited about the shipyard contracts that are coming into Vancouver right now. But let me tell you, those are minuscule to the shipyard activity that Vancouver found itself hosting in the early 40s. They were given the task of basically rebuilding Canada's merchant marine fleet, which was being used to supply the Allies, and ships were getting sunk by German U-boats as fast as they could build them, and so they put all the shipyards in Canada to work building ships as fast as they could. And during the 4 years that the wartime shipbuilding program was going on in Vancouver, in British Columbia, they built 300 ships. I mean, I don't know how many ships they're going to build in this new federal program. It's probably half a dozen or so. But 300 ships, and these were seagoing freighters, 10,000 tonners, and they had it was a similar situation to now. The shipyard industry had been allowed to sort of peter out. It had been big during the First World War, and they'd sort of let it fade away. So they had to conscript a whole bunch of people, and of course the men were away at war, and so they had a lot of women working there. The Rosie Riveter thing was going on, and they had 30,000 people altogether working in about six big shipyards in False Creek and on the North Shore. And so Bill went to work for them, and being an outspoken guy and a kind of a knothead, he said, well, okay, sure, we're helping to save the world here, but that doesn't mean that we should have to work in confined spaces breathing welding fumes until we pass out. That's no good. That's not going to help the war effort. We should get some ventilation in here. And so he was quickly appointed to be a shop steward, and he continued to be outspoken and active in trying to improve the conditions in the wartime yards, and was eventually elected the president of the Boilermakers Union, as it was called then, and then it became the Marine Workers later. And it was the largest local union in Canada, not the largest combined industrial union, but it was the largest union local. It had 30,000 members.
Bill was more than just an organizer for a union. He also became affiliated with the Communist Party. He chose that over the CCF, I guess, which was the other party claiming membership of working people. Why did he make the choice to go with the CP?
He found that when he stood up and complained about the conditions working down in the double bottoms of these ships, which were very confined spaces, and guys were passing out from the fumes down there all the time, and he was a welder, burner and welder, so he was facing this all the time, and so he tried to, you know, stand up and take a stand and demand better conditions, and was pretty effectively just brushed aside by the bosses, who were saying, we've got a war to fight here, we can't be bothered with your safety concerns, if you can't take it, you know, get out of the kitchen, this kind of talk. And the union at that time was very weak and sort of went along with the company on this. And so Bill found that he as one guy alone, it was very hard to get anywhere. But when he did stand up in meetings and in the yard and in wildcat strikes and so on, he found that there were a few other outspoken guys who would step forward and say, "Yeah, this guy's speaking the truth. We support him. Come on, let's get behind him." And he discovered that most of these other activists belonged to the Communist Party, which was very active at that time. It's moribund today, but their real active front was in labor, and they sent well-trained organizers into places like the shipyards, and tried to create more militancy in the labor movement. And so Bill just found that, well, these guys were experienced, they were willing to help, and he wanted to advance the cause of the workers. And so since they were the only people around that seemed to be interested in that, he'd join up with them. It was more from a labor activist's position that he was brought into the CP. I don't think previous to that time that he had a strong ideological leaning toward communism, but he just saw that they were very effective in the workplace, and they were well organized, and they had a lot of experience. And so if he wanted to really make some headway with working conditions, that they were good allies. And so he joined them as a very practical kind of decision, and stayed in the party for, about 5 or 6 years, and eventually had a falling out and left the party. But he saw it as and to his dying day, although he had strong reasons for leaving the party, he always maintained that the Communist Party and the old communist organizers like Harvey Murphy and Harold Prichette, who organized the IWA in the BC Woods, Ernie Dalscog, he said that those guys were just rock solid heroes of the labor, of the working class, and had done way more to build the Canadian labor movement and modern Canadian society than they were ever given credit for.
You wrote the book in 83, the story of Bill White, and you're reissuing it now. I guess we're living in a time of new surge of activism, of disgust with the conditions and inequities and injustices that people face, and it's sort of rippling around that sentiment. Do you think people could learn something from the experience of Bill White today, who came from a different era, but maybe was dealing with some of the same dynamics, or maybe he wasn't? So I'm sort of opening that up to you.
No, if he were here, he would say it never changes. He would say it's a them and us battle out there, the 99% against the 1%. He would accept that model without a blink of an eye, and that was always his position, that the serfs, the working class, the middle class, as they became later, whatever you want to call them, are always going to be on one side of the fence, and the controlling elite are always going to be on the other side of the fence, and their interests are never going to be the same. The one is always going to be trying to exploit the other, and unless the working class side of the fence catches on and learns how to fight back, they're just going to be oppressed more and more and more. And that was Bill's black and white view of the world, and he would be cheering on the Occupy movement today, saying, "Hey, you guys are finally getting the picture."
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Thanks for speaking with us, and recommend the book to all those young activists who are listening to the program this morning.
Okay, thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Howard White. He's author of A Hard Man to Beat, The Story of Bill White. That book is available from Harper Publishing, and you can find out more about the work of harperpublishing.com. They have a lot of other great books, and it's harperpublishing.com for the website.